At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the growing gloom. Thomas Hardy, The Darkling Thrush. Chapter 1. The letter was addressed to Mr. Colin Bliss. It sat on my desk, propped against the framed photograph of Antony and me. This reminded me that, as we were no longer an item, I really needed to dispose of that photograph of my chief and me. It was bound to look a trifle like I was sucking up, and I'd already done enough of that in every conceivable form. I picked up the cream envelope, studied it. There was no return address, which seemed curious. Brown ink, another curiosity. The Brivenators, like myself, in fact most of the Societas Magica, used blue. Other branches of the arcane services used purple. The general populace favored black. I couldn't think of any particular significance to brown. Perhaps the author simply liked the color. The problem with book hunters is we see a mystery every time pen is set to paper. One of the problems, anyway. I'd heard I had others. In detail, from Magister Septimus Marx. The handwriting was spidery and elegant. Absently, I turned the envelope over and tried to peruse it. I can't say I felt any kind of premonition. After all, my kind of trouble would hardly announce itself with heavy stationery and a fine hand. Who handwrote letters in these days of the Verityper, let alone letters like this one, which offered fleeting impressions of a genteel age and sumptuous living? An elderly person, male. An elegant drawing room with heavy velvet drapes, marble-topped chests, and a spread of tarot cards on the table. I picked up the pearl-handled letter opener and slit the envelope open.
Dear Mr. Bliss, allow me to introduce myself. I am Angus Anstruther, and I have the honor of being the presole of the Museum of the Literary Occult in London. I hope I am not being unduly modest in assuming that you are familiar with our own humble efforts to preserve the written heritage of our metaphysical past.
Amateurs. All too often, their helpful efforts were merely a guise for private collectors appropriating magical texts that more properly belonged in the official libraries. I glanced at the bottom of the note to see if Mr. Anstruther was requesting a donation. He was not. I continued reading.
You, of course, are the gifted author of Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, and the discoverer of Sir Florian Boltoff's memoirs. Recognizing that we share a certain fascination with lost treasures and written lore, I would very much like to formally make your acquaintance and perhaps propose a small but intriguing venture if you will be in town on the afternoon of the 13th of this month. We are having a private showing of the Boltoff Grimoire, and I would like to invite you to a viewing here at the museum at 2 o'clock. If you can attend, please confirm by telecom. Sincerely, Angus Anstruther.
The Boltoff Grimoire. Mr. Anstruther certainly knew with what temptation to bait his hook. Not that I wouldn't have been interested in a peek inside the Museum of the Literary Occult. It was one of several such places I'd hoped to visit when I had first arrived in London 8 weeks earlier, before I'd been distracted by other things. I frowned at the date. Double-checked my calendar. The 13th was the following day, not a lot of warning. Now that I was no longer in favor, taking off for an afternoon might prove problematic. Or perhaps not. I had the impression that Antony preferred as much as possible to forget I still existed. It was Basil, Antony's brother, and the procurator of Leslie's Lexicons, a front for our local branch of the Imperial Arcane Libraries, who was more likely to pitch a fit if I disappeared for the afternoon when I was supposed to be squirreled away in my cubicle, translating and transcribing ancient texts. The least interesting part of the job for me. I liked the hunt. I studied the number listed and then dialed it on the upright telephone on my desk, confirming shortly after, with a curt young woman, that I would indeed be available to attend the private showing at the Museum of the Literary Occult. I'd been hoping for such an invitation, but had never been able to determine who exactly the preso was over there. Not that I confided that to Miss Mildew, nor would she have been interested, as she obviously couldn't wait to get back to organizing paperclips. Hanging up the telephone, I glanced at Antony's photo again and turned it face down on the desk. He'd always looked rather supercilious in that picture, although at the time he'd gifted me with it, I hadn't noticed. I'd merely thought he looked like his mind was on important matters. When I glanced up again, Antony was standing in the doorway, and his expression matched the one I'd just buried in papers.
"Basil seems to feel there's a problem."
"Oh, jolly," I asked coolly. "With my work?"
"With your attitude."
Can anything be more awkward than being dumped romantically by one's superior? This is why one avoids office romance, if one has half a brain. Too bad for me, my little head got what the big head should have. I said, "I have no attitude, Antony. I'm here to do a job, and I'm doing it to the best of my ability."
"I'm glad to hear that,"
Antony said, looking anything but glad. He continued to stand in the doorway and frown at me. "Was there anything else?"
"No."
I opened Nessa Weber's excellent resource, Weird Words, and picked up my pen to make notations on the manuscript before me. I felt Antony watching, but still he said nothing. Tall, lean, handsome in an inbred way, like so many of the English aristocracy, Antony had sandy-colored, thinning hair, blue eyes, charmingly crooked teeth. What in the name of all was it about him I found so irresistible? Even now, when I couldn't stand him. When he finally turned away without speaking, I felt that inevitable lurch of disappointment. "Antony," I said, and I winced inwardly at the urgency of my tone. He paused, glancing back. It was not an encouraging look. I said, "I've been invited to a special showing of the Botov Grimoire at the Museum of the Literary Occult tomorrow afternoon. Is it all right if I take off early?"
"You've been invited."
He considered this and said at last,
"Of course. If you've actually received an invitation, you must go."
He hesitated.
"I believe Magister Marx is also attending. You might have a word with him. Perhaps you can go together."
"All right." No way on earth was I going anywhere with that arrogant, judgmental bastard Septimus Marx. Antony left. I rested my forehead in my hand, pretending to stare at the blank pages before me. 2 months ago, I'd arrived in jolly old England as part of the colonial exchange program between bureaus of the Societas Magica. And about 4.5 minutes after I'd first arrived at Leslie's Lexicons, a dusty and labyrinthine monstrosity that served as the public face of one of the most extraordinary collections of arcane and occult tomes in the Empire, I'd met Antony Leslie, the preso. Antony was charming and handsome and knowledgeable, and I was a long way from home. He took me to dinner, explained and thanked me for the important work we colonials were doing for the society and mankind. And then he took me back to my hotel and treated me to some of the best sex of my life. Our affair lasted 7 weeks. In addition to being charming, handsome, and knowledgeable, Antony was married. It hadn't seemed like a problem initially. If there was a problem, it was Antony's, right? But 7 weeks later, seduced and abandoned, as they used to say in ye good old days, and having managed to thoroughly isolate myself from my colleagues, I began to understand that it was my problem too, and I had displayed some staggeringly awful judgment, not least in falling for a man who wore ties as wide as Antony's. so I really didn't need Septimus Marx looking down his long and arrogant nose at me, or curling his thin mouth in one of those sneering smiles, because he'd turned out to be absolutely right about, well, pretty much everything. Marx also worked at Leslie's Lexicons, although I was never quite sure at what. He was a magister, a master of some field of study within the Societas Magica, the branch of the arcane services that dealt with written magic. I suspected he was one of the dreaded Vox Pessimeres, one of those taxed with the terrible job of destroying those magical texts too dangerous or powerful to remain in circulation, or even on the shelves of the Imperial Arcane Libraries. Even if it was true, no one would admit it. The identities of the Vox Pessimeres were protected. Perhaps it was a necessary job, but most of us within the Societas Magica found it despicable. Which was probably why I was willing to believe it of him. Marx was often in the field, although in his case, being in the field seemed to encompass everything from conferring with black market booksellers to retrieving stranded colleagues, which is how we happened to meet the day I arrived on English soil. Marx picked me up at the airport. He had been unimpressed then, and he was, if possible, less impressed now. And I tended to agree with him. The Museum of the Literary Occult was located opposite Telescope House on Great Loudon Street. It was a grand-looking building in the classical style. Lots of fluted columns and sculptured friezes. It looked like the headquarters for the Imperial Arcane Library should have looked. It was certainly much grander than Leslie's Lexicons, and in fact, it was one of the largest private collections of magical and occult texts in the world. According to my pocket watch, it was a few minutes to two. I was greeted by a very young, very pretty, male secretary in a green velvet suit, to what I guessed was the Prisil's inner sanctum. "Are the other guests downstairs?" I inquired. "Oh, the viewing's not until 3. I puzzled this over as he tapped discreetly on a mahogany door behind an enormous embroidered tapestry of Callistra's Enchantment of the Infidels. A voice bade us enter. The secretary gripped the ring of twisted brass and pushed open the door. He stepped to the side. I went past him into a large office. I had a quick impression of long black velvet drapes, wallpaper of gold-watered silk, and bookshelves behind leaded glass. A very large woman sat before a very large desk. The desk was highly polished. The woman was not. She looked like she'd been blown in on a hard wind. Her salt-and-pepper hair stood up in tufts, her blue silk suit looked slightly crooked, and her red lipstick was outside the lines of her wide mouth. Her smile of welcome seemed too bright in the muted light of the office. "Mr. Bliss," she said. The beauty of her voice, a honeyed contralto, was unexpected. "How wonderful of you to come on such short notice." Behind the desk sat a small, plump, elderly man. He was quite bald, and resembled a very old baby, though there was nothing youthful in his glittering black eyes. He surveyed me measuringly, unsmilingly. He did not rise and did not offer his hand. "I'm Lady Margaret Lavenham," the woman said. "I am the museum procurator. This is Mr. Anstruther, our Prisil." "How do you do?" I said politely. Anstruther nodded. "Sit down, Mr. Bliss." I took a spindly chair across from Lady Lavenham. "I thought you would be older," Anstruther said. "I'm 23.
23?
"I've been book hunting for 3 years.
3 years is a great deal of book hunting experience," Lady Lavenham commented.
Anstruther said,
"When you get to be my age, 23 is very young."
He continued to eye me. I knew only too well what he saw. It was a source of irritation to me that I looked quite a bit younger than my age, being small and slender, with wide blue eyes and a mop of strawberry blonde curls. I tried growing a beard at one time, but the result wasn't worth the crumb catching.
"Tea, I think,"
the Lavenham woman said. She was speaking to the small brownie sitting on the very top of the red lacquered chinoiserie cabinet in the corner.
The brownie brightened and disappeared in a flash. A few moments later, the door flew open, and the pretty secretary returned with a laden tea tray. Lady Lavendum served hot, flowered-scented tea in blue and white china cups.
"No biscuits?" Mr. Anstruther objected, scowling at the tray.
"There are the little cakes you like, the ones with the slivered almonds."
"But no biscuits."
"No, I'm afraid not." Mr. Anstruther expelled an exasperated breath.
"Do you like biscuits with your tea, Mr. Bliss?"
"When they're available."
"There is no reason biscuits can't always be available."
Anstruther gave Lady Lavendum a pointed look. She smiled apologetically at me. "Next time we'll certainly have biscuits." "This is fine," I said. "The cakes are lovely." No one replied. We sipped our tea, nibbled our cakes. I glanced surreptitiously at the marble clock on the carved bookshelf and wondered what I was doing there. At last, Mr. Anstruther took one final slurp of his tea, rattled the cup back in the saucer, and said,
"Mr. Bliss, have you heard of the Fella Sahoif?"
"The Sword Shadow?" "Yes, of course. According to legend, it was the great grimoire of the witches of the Western Isles."
"That is not merely a legend."
I opened my mouth, but it occurred to me that arguing with Mr. Anstruther would not be useful.
"It is not a legend," he repeated. "The grimoire exists, and we want you to find it."